another edition of All You Ever Needed to Know and Wish You Didn't. This is We the People Radio with Aaron and Elizabeth and
Don't
Bob
scare
Martin.
Everybody already?
You know, I was at the Veterans Cemetery yesterday. I go with the wreath ceremony that they have out there, and one of our folks came up to me and she said, "Wow, your program last week really scared me. I went to church. I had something to pray about. Are you going to scare us again tomorrow?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so."
We're like, "Yeah, sure, we have a super scary guy. We've never really talked to him, but seems scary." It seems like everything that's going on is scary these days.
George Norrie better watch out.
Yeah, George Norrie, he thinks he's got it over on us. I don't think so. Hey, so this is KCNR 1460, the home of Free Fire Media in the Shasta-Redding area. If you haven't called in before, we are all about everything that fits under the umbrella of fiscal responsibility, limited government, and most importantly, adherence to the Constitution.
Nice broad brush. You can't,
very broad.
Yeah, can't go wrong.
It's amazing how much fits under that umbrella.
Yeah. So we started focusing kind of on property rights a while back. We decided, let's not just talk about regular stuff. Let's talk about things that typically you have to kind of hunt for in the media, or you have to have some connection to. And property rights issues oftentimes, they only involve the people that are directly affected. Hey, there's a webcam in here now.
Uh-oh.
I just noticed. I'm like, hey, what are all those cords for? Hey, there's two webcams. Oh, they have covers on them, though, so.
Now they get to watch it. Pull the microphone.
So you have to pretend.
It's our new security system we're installing because of programs like this one.
Nice.
Aren't you supposed to have the Attack Watch theme that plays in the background when you say that?
I got to get that ready.
Yeah, thank you. You got to get the Attack Watch ready.
So the property rights issues, like you said, you know, it just seems like the only people that jump up and speak out are the ones that are directly affected. But what most people don't realize is that they start at the outside and work their way in.
Yeah.
If you like to eat and you need water, it will affect you.
Well, you know, the reason I brought that up was primarily because we had this fish and game meeting last Thursday night here in Redding, and I know they've been having them other places in the state too. And you know, if you don't live in California, they're coming to your state too. But they're putting out this new visioning thing. And, of course, you know you're in trouble when you walk in. And just in case people don't know the name for meetings like that, it's called the Delphi Technique, where they have everything in those little work groups. You know, they're not actually going to tell you anything. And then they let you know on your way in the door that they're not capturing any of your comments, that you have to go home and submit them all online.
Yeah, when I signed in.
It's like, what are we here for?
When I signed in, they specifically said, we will not be taking notes tonight.
Yeah. So not only do you not get, you're not being informed of anything, but you're there to share. We were there to share. I was like, I wasn't very good at sharing when I was a kid. I'm certainly not good at it now.
And I wanted to tell you that the thing that I find interesting is we go to a lot of these public meetings. You know, the State Water Board, as an example. I would like to know why all of these state agencies need to have armed personnel at these public meetings.
Well, they will tell you that is because they are there to answer questions about enforcement.
Oh, and so their guns are show and tell?
Well, that's part of their uniform.
Oh, all right.
So, how do you feel about the tax dollars being used? Because, let's see, they were blown away at the turnout, which was probably, I'm kind of guessing, like maybe 80 people.
Yeah, they were surprised that anybody showed because nobody's showing anywhere else.
But if, in fact, people weren't showing up elsewhere, there were like a dozen people in these other meetings, it would have been a one-to-one ratio
on
personnel to attendees, which was bizarre.
That's how many they had. And, you know, if you read the blogs on our local newspaper the next day, it's interesting how many people feel that
they don't like me. Oh yeah, there was that too.
Well, there's that. Yeah, and how many of those folks that actually didn't go to the meetings felt like there was an overreaction on the part of the citizens when they complained about the fact that there were so many armed personnel, and there was one person in particular that doesn't care for our show, Aaron. But apparently they're listening to it because they were able to talk about their dissatisfaction over the fact that we make too many jokes.
They said that I'm snarky
and that we laugh about everything.
Yeah.
So I would encourage that person to call in and give their side of the story. The number is 530-605-4567, and thank you for listening.
Or jump in online, wethepeopleradio.us. You can catch the archive of this program anytime after we air.
And seriously, I think we have a cult following.
We're going to reinvent cult following. But, Tim Herden from the Capital Press did a really good blog on that visioning thing. So for those of you that are kind of going, what, you know, what fishing game thing? Go online to We the People Radio, and Robert will put up a link. You can go to the Support Rural America site, and it's on there. But California Fishing Game. Here are just a couple of hot points, reasons why you might care about this. They want to, the proposed action items, okay, this is still in the works. It's going to be presented next July. But reasons you may want to comment and or follow the issue. They want to utilize efforts by partners to promote. Ooh, I'm feeding back. Here. Oh, I think your sound's on. To promote the fish and game mission, i.e. the Humane Society, enforcement efforts, resource conservation district, landowner outreach. Okay, Humane Society should be a massive red flag. They make PETA look, you know, like the right wing. Another item, increase the number of wardens. That'll make everybody happy. Increase both fines and penalties, with fines used to pay resources needed to implement.
Now, keep in mind,
super,
that fish and game can't run to the state legislature and get paid out of the general fund anymore. So they've been given carte blanche to fine and fee us to death so that they can support their personnel.
You guys are going to like these two. Create law enforcement specialty units within the Department of Fish and Game Law Enforcement Division comprised of additional enforcement positions that you'll be paying for. Here's my all-time favorite, though. Environmental Crimes Unit. That's what they want. They want an Environmental Crimes Unit specializing in the investigation of fish and game code sections. 1600, stream bed alteration, and 5650, water pollution and stream bed habitat destruction. So they're going to have their own crimes unit. And just in case you're wondering, well, you know, the jails are full, the courts are busy, how are they going to do that? Oh, no, they're going to increase the size of the special operations covert unit. That's fantastic. And develop a cadre of experienced prosecutors to charge and try these cases. So they're going to have like their own special prosecutors now. Fish and Game is becoming the man. So, yeah, just in case you weren't following that, I will send this to Robert. He'll get it up on the website. And so WeThePeopleRadio.us, you can see all this good stuff and links to more of same.
Yeah, and, you know, if you thought Fish and Game, their purpose in life was to go after poachers and illegal hunting, how much poaching and illegal hunting do you think was going on Thursday night inside the museum at Turtle Bay?
I saw you over there fiddling with some of the exhibits, Elizabeth. I saw you.
I know, and they were there for me.
That's why we go. So, anyway, super super spooky stuff going on there, guys.
What's happening tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night, we have more super spooky stuff.
Super
if you're
excited.
Anywhere near Reading, you should come to the Reading Tea Party at 6 o'clock because we have Rosa Corey.
Now, if you haven't heard about Rosa Corey, she was on our show several months ago, and she's from Santa Rosa. She is the creator and founder of Democrats Against Agenda 21.
UN Agenda 21.
UN, yes, UN Agenda. And if folks out there listening have not heard of Agenda 21, just Google it. There's no shortage of information. And the thing that I like about Rosa Corey, number one, she's brilliant. She's a forensic appraiser, and she appraises things like the Bay Bridge. Spends a lot of time in court, has to know her stuff because it has to stand up in a court of law. And she sort of dispels all of the rumors about the Tea Party movement. First of all, she's a diehard Democrat. Right?
Yep.
Apparently we're funded by the Republicans. But I believe that she travels the state of California, speaking engagements everywhere, and primarily addresses a lot of Tea Party groups.
Yep. So she'll be up here, and we will have her on the radio on Christmas, actually.
Yeah.
We thought, what a nice way to have her come out of town, and we'll pre-record.
And
Bob
will
have some nice Christmas music for you, so you can listen to Rosa on Christmas Day if you're not in the Reading area and you don't get to hear her tomorrow
and
night.
And she will be at the Reading Tea Party, 6 o'clock, 2570 South Bonneview Road. I really encourage all of you to attend.
Yeah, it's free.
Yeah.
We'll take your donation if you got it. So we can pay the light bill, but other than that, it's free.
And, you know, we are educational. We provide the forum. We provide the speakers. We provide the expertise. The rest is up to you.
And we're fun.
Apparently that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, fun isn't for everyone, is it?
Hey, some of these things are so ridiculous, you have no choice but to make fun of them.
Exactly. Don't make me be snarky.
You're sounding good this morning, Marge.
I know. I'm.
Except when you laugh. You need good to cut one. Back on the smoking.
Yeah. Which I've never done, by the way. Long as I mind, if I would have smoked, I would have lived to have been in kindergarten. Hey, let's take a really quick break and come back with William, and then the whole program will be about that. So we're coming back, and we're going to talk about environmental fascism. And I know a lot of people are going, exactly. So you're going to find out what William Kay's take is on that. And I would read you his bio, but I don't have one. So
he'll fill in the blanks.
Yeah,
for us.
So he's going to tell us all about it when we come back. We'll be back in just 2 minutes. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charge the people $1.50 just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Welcome back to We the People Radio. Be prepared to get scared.
That's no fair. You can't just change the thing.
Sorry, guys.
Aaron's voice is scaring me.
You watch it, Bob. I can get around this table, but we probably shouldn't do it until we have webcams because it'll be funnier that way. I'll trip over Elizabeth.
There's three cameras in here.
There are?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's another one behind me.
We are.
I'm obviously not very observant.
I'll give you the actual explanation. We're trying to get a video stream up for Carl and Linda Bott's weekday morning show, Free Fire Radio.
Okay.
Nice. So if we come running in here and go, hi, everybody, people will see us. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. And then we'll no longer be anonymous.
Yeah.
Anonymous, yeah. Snarky radio host.
Yes.
So, William, are you in there?
I am.
So did we build you up enough? Actually, we couldn't.
We couldn't.
You're scaring me. Yeah.
You're scaring me. So we let folks know right at the outset, William's website is on ours, but if you want to go directly to it, it's ecofascism.com. Snappy name. I like it.
I'll hang on to it.
You should. Yeah, keep
paying. Apparently it's worth $11. I just checked.
Oh, that's fantastic. Don't you just love that? You have like 8 million domains, cost you hundreds of dollars to renew, and they're worth nothing. Okay, so we really know very little about you, but you came highly recommended and said you knew a whole bunch of fun stuff, and we've been reading on your website, and I was reading last night about I went to bed after reading the American Oligarchy's Economic Warfare Campaign.
Oh, that was one of my earlier pieces. I'm a work in progress. The main problem that people have in trying to understand environmentalism is it's hard to keep three things in your mind at once. It's easy to keep two things there, but to juggle three things is difficult. Earlier, I was listening to your discussion there, and you referred to, one group, the Humane Society, made PETA look right-wing. I am of the view that the environmental movement is, in fact, a far right-wing movement. It is not a left-wing movement. And there's a perception, certainly, in the mainstream American community and in Canada as well, that environmentalism is somehow a leftist or a socialist movement. Historically, there was a left, right, and center. What we refer to as liberalism was a pro-capitalist, pro-free-enterprise, pro-democracy point of view. It was challenged from the left and from the right. The environmental movement, as has all previous fascist movements, tend at times to wrap themselves in the garb of as a leftist movement. But it's really a movement of the far right, and it's a much distinct movement from any sort of leftist thing. What we're calling the old left is pretty much a vanquished force in America and throughout much of the world. The environmental movement definitely has its roots in the fascist movement, which is a movement of the radical right. They are certainly anti-capitalist, and they are definitely anti-democratic. But it's really a mistake to mingle them up with sort of, you know, the trade union movement and the socialist movement and those sorts of movements. That is the big mistake. You know, I would view the sort of ideology that I'm hearing coming from your show today as being sort of a mainstream centrist pro-republic, you know, pro-free enterprise point of view. Environmentalism represents elite groups that want to replace capitalism and replace democracy with a highly statist system, but they are by no means are they socialists or levelers or fighters for the common people.
Yeah, that's true, because at the end of the day, well, just the excerpts I read from the new Fish and Game proposal, at the end of the day, they rule us.
The core thing, the roots of environmentalism, as with the roots of fascism, stem from a struggle of the old land-owning classes against capitalism. When capitalism first emerged in Europe, the old aristocrats rallied against it. And time and time again, there have been these clashes in Europe between this old guard and those who advocate sort of a capitalist, republican, democratic world. As I try to point out, there's one of the recent reviews that it's called, if anyone goes to my website right now, you'll notice there's two columns. There's one of articles and there's one of reviews. On the right side, one of my newer reviews is just a priceless book that came out of Oxford a few years ago called The Royals and the Reich. And it's the first time this has really come out, but within the German Nazi Party, there were 270 hereditary princes. And they played lead roles throughout the whole Third Reich. And that is a common feature you will find throughout the European fascist movement, is that it was dominated by kings and princes and these old aristocrats. That has been airbrushed completely out of history. People, whatever people view of the fascist movement, and I'm talking about the classical fascist movement, you know, from 1918 to 1945, that was indisputably a movement of the aristocrats of Europe. You know, Mussolini's famous March on Rome, that came after King Victor appointed him prime minister, not before. And King Victor, 20 years later, fired Mussolini. You know, the Savoy family was in control of Italy throughout the entire fascist era. And that has been erased from history. But to the core economic struggle is that, you know, people who believe in free enterprise always want new land open for development. They want to be able to do with their land what they want to. People who own, like a lot of the old aristocrats who own large blocks of land, don't want to flood the market with new land development. So they're always seeking ways to suppress the development of new land. You folks live in California. 44.5% of all the land in California is owned by the U.S. federal government. In Canada, we have even more absurd. I've been living in Alberta right now. It's almost 70% of the land is owned by the government.
Wow.
You know, if they wanted to solve the economic crisis, and this has been pointed out by a number of people, just open up this land for development. I lived in British Columbia. 97% of the land is owned by the government, and that is a greater land mass, if you can believe it, than California. But once you go west to Chicago in the United States, over half the land is owned by the U.S. federal government. There was a period, when the Puritans came, they gave every family that got off a boat a free farm. Like, here you go, here's your Bible, here's your farm. It was considered God's work and a good duty to clear land, to create farms, to create agricultural zones. This was considered a good thing to do. In period, there was a reaction to this, certainly coming from the British Crown and the British aristocracy, to stop this. This leads to the American Revolution. Then there's a period of freezing up again before the Civil War. After the Civil War, with Abraham Lincoln and the great railway land grants and what have you, and we had similar things in Canada, there was a great throwing open of land. It was called the Homestead Movement. And that Lincoln signed law that, you know, he would give 160 acres free to anybody who come and wanted to set up a farm in the U.S. West. And this led to a mass migration of Europeans to the United States. This, of course, was greeted with great horror in Europe. They were losing all these farmers, and they dangling the idea of a free farm to a tenant farmer in Europe was just too much. And they came in great droves. It wasn't until Teddy Roosevelt and that whole movement that they started to clam up again, and they started to, you know, create these great parks and great land set aside, and eventually they killed the homestead movement. The Sierra Club was created specifically to stop homesteading. The idea that, you know, the homestead movement is based on the idea that if you go out and clear 160 acres, you have a farm up and running on it, it's called proving up. If you can actually make something up, get a farm and a house on there, we'll give you the deed. You know, and this is a great stimulus to activity, economic activity. It's how they paid for the railways. They gave the railway companies large amounts of land, which they then could then sell and give out to homesteaders. And this is how the West was won. But once you get into the, you know, the American environmental movement, I date to the 1860s. It actually sort of exists before then, but it was clearly a recognizable form in the 1860s, not the 1960s. They definitely dominated U.S. politics in the, you know, 1890 pre-World War I era. Then they sort of slid back a bit, and they started coming back again in the 1960s. But this is a very old movement, and it's about making sure that land is not dealt with in sort of capitalist ways or free market ways. It's a way to hoard land. It's a way to keep people from using land the way they want to. That's one of the main aspects of it. And just to give you sort of an idea as to, you know, what land magnates look like and what the core of the environmental movement is, there's a book I reviewed called Cahill's Who Owns the World. And it profiles many of the world's largest landowners. And these people are also almost invariably major financiers of environmentalism. And there are people like the Duke of Westminster. He owns about 400 city blocks in downtown London. There's a family in Spain that owns over 2,500 square miles of land. They own almost all the land in Toledo and through there. These people have vast amounts of land that are sitting idle. And they're sitting vacant. What they do not want to see is sort of this race to the bottom where governments throw open all kinds of new land for development. They clear forests and what have you. That is not in their interest. They are very much in the interest in suppressing land development. And that, in many ways, is the, you know, core constituency of the environmental movement, and it was the core constituency of the fascist movement. There.
There.
There, I said
comment.
Yeah. Hey, so I'm just...
wanted to make sure my phone was still working.
Yeah, no, that was good. That was good.
It was a very focused rant.
So describe your political view, utilitarianism.
Yes. Oh, you want me to define that?
Yeah, you've got it on your website.
Except for, hold on, can we do it after the break? Because it's 8:30. William's watching his clock.
I'm sorry, we need coffee.
Give me time to invent the definition. We would love to give you that kind of time. We'll be back.
Okay. Are we breaking?
Yes, we are. We'll be back in 2 minutes here at We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Land. This is where we gotta make a stand. The stewards of this land are mom and pop. The government didn't run a soda shop. I said freedom, freedom. Watch it slipping away. I said freedom, freedom. A little bit more each day. They'd say I want a revolution. I'd say you need to pay attention.
Welcome back to We the People Radio. That was Mike Smith from Corning, California. Just wanted to point you in the direction of some incredible patriotic and conservative music. Big Dog Music Mafia. That's dog spelled D-A-W-G. Check out their website. You'll find Mike Smith and many others from around the country. Everyday people with incredible talent telling the truth through their music.
Isn't that how you spell dog?
Depends on what world you're coming from.
Deputy dog.
Hey, and join us. The chat room is alive and well at wethepeopleradio.us. You'll go to our media page where Robert has put up all of the links to today's show and today's guest, as well as all the archive shows from the past year. And you can click on any one of those archive shows. Don't make fun of me, Aaron.
Okay, I'll look at the other way. Sorry. You can feel me looking at you.
Yeah. Okay, so my tongue doesn't work this morning. So what? Anyway, click on any one of those shows and send it out via email to everyone that you know.
If you stare at her, you can strike her dumb.
That was funny.
I wasn't even going to do anything. I was just looking at you. Just watching you talk.
Hey, I know your little wheels.
The little wheels are spinning
in your head.
Can you hear my hamsters running? Hey, you know, I've got all these people in the chat room. They're like, so what's the point? What's the point? What are we talking about? Where's this going?
God, everybody's so touchy.
Well, you know, we're just setting it up. We're just walking into it.
You guys, we're only in the first half hour. Come on.
Come on, William.
Got an hour and a half to go. Hey, William, so on your website, you talk about the political orientation of your webpage being utilitarian. I wanted to address that. And also, you describe the struggle against fascism, actually fascism, as being an extreme reactionary movement.
Yes.
Please elaborate.
Well, there's two points there. Utilitarianism, I think, was first used as a word in 1802 by Jeremy Bentham. It basically means pursuing policies that create the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. It's an inherently democratic and liberal in the sense of, you know, do your own thing, baby, liberalism. And it's at that time was very much pro-capitalist and against a lot of state suppression of initiative. Both socialism and capitalism are utilitarian philosophies. They both advocate, you know, they both claim to advocate policies to create, you know, prosperity and betterment of the welfare. You remember the old Nixon-Khrushchev kitchen speeches where they sit there and they were arguing about, you know, which system, you know, could really bring home the bacon, which system could really produce the greatest wealth and the greatest happiness for the population. And you start to think, well, everybody advocates that. Everyone claims that their point of view, their political ideology is the one that's going to create the greatest happiness. But take another look at environmentalism. They're not trying to make policies that are in the best interests of people. They're claiming that their policies are in the best interest of the planet. You know, it's a ruse, because what they really are doing is putting forward policies that are in the best interest of a certain small constituency of people. When utilitarianism was first debuted, a great many people would argue that, you know, policy should be in the best interest of the king. Policy should be in the best interest of God. And all sorts of other things that weren't exactly the best interest of most people. So, out of utilitarianism, you find all sorts of, you know, varying threads. But what we're seeing a revival of now are people who are coming out point blank and saying, you know, yeah, we know this is not in the best interest of the people of California, but we're really concerned about these small toads that live in the desert. And, you know, we're afraid that, you know, this economic development is going to dislocate these toads or minnows or whatever it is that they claim to be defending. It's always a ruse. They really are defending the economic interests of a certain constituency. But officially, that ideology is not utilitarian. They don't make any bones about it. They're here to defend the planet against the people. In terms of reactionary, I mean that, you know, back to the, you know, the French Revolution all the way through forward, there has been this steady march towards, you know, free enterprise and democracy, and there has been this old guard that has resisted this at every step of the way. And they certainly have a fifth column in America. And they have reacted time and again. Fascism was just one other wave of reaction that swept across Europe. And just hold that thought. You know, in 1941, from the gates of Moscow to the White Cliffs of Dover, every country in Europe was under a fascist dictatorship. Germany was not the first country that went fascist. Germany was the ninth country that went fascist. And In the core of it, again, you'll find these, you know, there are, right now there are 9 monarchies in Europe. And there, in, inside many of the republics, you'll find that there's these aristocratic families that utterly dominate the political process. They are reviving themselves. And the period with which they have, you know, revived themselves most recently is coterminous with and inextricably intertwined with the rise of environmentalism. Environmentalism is a much more powerful force in Europe than it is in America.
How so?
Oh, go to countries like, you know, Germany. The Green Party there is, you know, the second or third largest party in most districts. And the Green Party doesn't win their, you know, their ballot deposit back in America.
Yeah, no.
In terms of, you know, recycling and organic foods and restrictions on land development, far greater in Europe. The transition per capita to renewable energy is far greater in Europe. So the belief in global warming, far greater in Europe than it is in America.
And so is it just a function of time that they got people to buy into that? Because people here, you know, even people who kind of, they want to recycle and this and that and the other, but when they are watching it just destroy the economy and then affect their private property, is it because there hasn't been such independence in Europe that they let that kind of slide in as much as they did? Is that why we're fighting it?
They never, in many of these countries, you know, America has a very long tradition of democracy and free enterprise that simply do not exist in other parts of the world. In many of these countries, you have to travel through Europe to realize how powerful these monarchies still are. Basically, I live in Canada. This is a monarchy. This is not a democracy. The head of state is the governor general, not the prime minister. And the governor general is an appointee of the House of Windsor. When you go through a lot of the countries like, you know, Luxembourg and Liechtenstein, we have absolute monarchies there. And so that's one factor. And within that constituency, you will find a real hostility to wide-open capitalism. They're not, like, you know, completely into suppressing capitalism. Environmentalism isn't that. It's all about sustainable development. They advocate this highly regulated form of capitalism, which is highly restrictive. And they don't care if it's a slow-growth system. Much environmental propaganda is dedicated towards that. You know, we believe in the steady state economy. We don't, you know, we don't feel ourselves bound by this addiction to growth that you people have. They're happy with massive unemployment and all that comes with that.
Wow.
Cheap labor.
And in Canada, because see, I mean, I don't know a lot about Canada, but I think most of us see you guys as being kind of like we are.
Oh, you probably could not find two countries, you know, less similar. Canada is almost identical to the United States. I've traveled through the States a number of times. But, yeah, we speak the same language, very similar cultures. You know, that's a given. Canada and the United States are almost identical in terms of culture.
So politically, does this stuff play in Canada? I mean, can they get away with all this?
Keep in mind that, you know, the big problem that we're confronting is that there's all these resources in North America, land, coal, oil, gas, timber, what have you, that we can't get our hands on. We, the people. If you think it's an issue in the United States, and a lot of people do, cast your eyes to the north. You know, I grew up in a province called Saskatchewan. It is a greater land mass than California. It's hard for Americans to conceive that. But it's got 1 million people in it. So imagine sort of a suburb of Los Angeles, and that's all there is in California. And yet even there, there's an environmental movement saying that we're overdeveloping this place.
Oh, jeez.
And you find that all over Canada. I mean, there's just mind-boggling natural resources that are being locked down that people can't get at. And, you know, I've seen this time and again, you know, multi-billion-dollar mining projects getting killed by the environmental movement. It's definitely happening in the United States as well. And that's why, you know, your whole, you know, cabal of politicians there, it's just the liars' club. You know, politicians who talk about, you know, we're for prosperity, we're for, you know, getting America working again, and yet they're sitting on all this oil and gas off the coast of the United States. They're sitting on enormous quantities of oil in the oil shales in, you know, Colorado, Utah area that are being prohibited from being developed. They're transitioning away from coal-fired electricity, while the United States is the Saudi Arabia of coal. Yeah. If you really want to get America going again, eliminate these environmental restrictions, throw open this land for development, and you will have an unprecedented economic boom. It's not hard to see what the problem is. Someone's got their foot slammed on the brake. That's the problem.
Yeah, like what we see here in California. I mean, see it a lot of other places in the other states as well. But you know, they want to take out hydropower dams for what? I mean, they want to
blow them up. I know they're knocking holes in them.
Yeah, they want to take out hydropower dams. I read an article. I should post it. I didn't read the whole thing yet, but it was basically some environmental bunch that was pitching that the sediment, the tonnage of sediment that comes from behind these dams when they blow them, along with the heavy metals and everything else, is actually good for the fishery.
And how do they swim through sludge?
Exactly. I was like, what? I mean, these guys could spin anything.
I mean, iron is a crucial part of our diet. Like, many of the things they claim are poisonous are, in fact, good for us. But the point is, you've got to break free from this whole religion of nature.
Yeah.
I don't want to preserve nature. What is there to preserve? It's a myth to begin with. I mean, since when did it become our goal to reconstruct North America as it was in 1491? To whom does that benefit?
Well,
you know, what is the benefit from blocking off a vast area of forest just so the birds and the bugs can carry on?
No, it's so that it can overgrow, catch on fire, and become sterilized,
yeah.
Actually.
So
that's really what it does.
Until the next ice age comes along and just completely wipes it out. Mother Nature is cruel. Mother Nature is full of toxins. You know, Mother Nature is hardly something that we want to keep around. I'm all for development. There was the utilitarian sort of framework. Is someone who goes and drains a swamp and creates a farm has done a good thing. To the environmentalist, he's destroyed a wetland. He's endangered this ecosystem. That's we've got to completely snap free from this religion of nature. There's no great merit in preserving swamps.
Well, the killer too is that some of the things that we're preserving weren't actually there. We're preserving mythical.
We're preserving second growth forests.
But we're preserving mythical a mythical past, because a lot of times, especially we see that up here, the quality of, say, the Klamath River up there in that basin is not of this pristine nature, and yet they want to return it to its pristine nature. Well, it never had that. So now we're going to return it to a place it's never been. So really, we're just going to change it to make it more like what they think it should be.
It's a valid point. I mean, this whole thing is phony. It's phony as a $4 bill. You know, what the really at the root of it is suppressing economic development. And they've created this vast religious army of eco-nuts who are, willing to lay down in front of bulldozers and cause all kinds of grief to developers to stop this. But there is, within it, there is a core group who know what they're trying to do. They are trying to suppress economic development, and this is a form of economic warfare.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer. You know, think of that 44% of California that is owned by the U.S. federal government. What if they were to auction that off? How much money would that raise, point A? And point B, if they put those kinds of restrictions, like the homestead restrictions, you had to do something with the land. You had to do something of economic value with that land. California would experience an enormous economic explosion.
The Forest Service locally just recently sold a building that they were originally housed in. I think they just sold it for $13
million. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know where that money's going.
They occasionally toss out a little crumb here or there. But I used to do a radio show in Vancouver, and I interviewed the chief bureaucrat in the British Columbia government who was in charge of land sales. And this is a province, once again, larger than California, 97% owned by the government. And I said, see, you check their website, and occasionally there's an acre here for sale, or there's an acre there. I said, how do you guys go about determining how much land you're going to put up for a sale? Because we're very careful that whatever we do does not lower the overall price of land. That's the root of it.
Yeah.
I'm currently working on an essay about the city of Edmonton, which I live in now, You know, it's Edmond is almost entirely green space. You know, there's, you know, I would guess, you know, within city limits, 200 square miles of green space.
Wow.
The world's largest urban park.
Jeez.
Yet land prices are really high here. People are paying $400,000 for a house. And yet we're sitting on this massive amount of green space, and, you know, the city government will not, you know, dump this land on the market for fear of, you know, A, causing an economic boom, which would transfer capital from other parts of the world, and B, they're careful not to lower the value of land.
Yeah, we'd hate to,
easily do.
Hate to get the property taxes flowing so that we could, you know, get some basic services going. Hey, we've got to take a really quick break here. Otherwise, we're just going to be on a big, long break. We'll have it all jammed up in one spot. So we'll be back with William Kay here at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Go on, read a little bit. Got 2 minutes. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
We don't need no education. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Closing in quickly on the first hour of We the People Radio. If you don't like the chat, you've got to love the music. Tune in for something. The number to call is 530-605-4567 or join the chat room at wethepeopleradio.us.
Okay. I promised George in the chat room that I would ask William, hold on, I got to scroll back. Whoops. Every time somebody posts, it changes it. Darn it. Now, he wanted to know, what does William think about the Native American view of the earth?
Oh, I don't think there is a specific Native American view of the earth. They were an illiterate people, so we really don't know what they thought about much before we got here. I do know that the Native American view has been, the Native American movement has been pretty much co-opted by the environmental movement, and they are, in many instances, facilitating a suppression of economic development. They're blocking through land claims and what have you. They're also helping them block a lot of development. The Native American movement is very much divided. There are elements within that movement that are working with industry and trying to get things going. You see it very clearly here in Canada. There's some bitter disputes over pipelines and land claims, and there have been some very valuable economic projects that have been more or less bogged down by native land claims,
now,
with the environmental movement running shotgun.
Now, William, do you think that's because the government's made them promises?
Their whole sense of entitlement, I guess it has a long history. I'm really opposed to any sort of special privileges to any sort of racial group. In Canada, it's a real problem. They have a tremendous sense of entitlement. The movement itself is led by people who are Aboriginal supremacists, who are anti-white racist, and who are receiving enormous amounts of money from large environmental foundations and what have you, and they are successfully obstructing economic development. It's the greatest problem facing Canada right now is this rising native movement, and they're in the process right now blocking some major pipelines and what have you. It's a real problem. They have a sense of entitlement that is just mind-blowing, and a real sense that they are not part of the country and that they are not subject to the country's rules and laws. That is also very widespread. You have similar things in the States, not to the degree that we have them in Canada. They have similar problems in Australia and Brazil and what have you. The environmental movement is mobilizing the native movement as another mechanism with which to block economic development. And many of the natives are buying into this wholeheartedly. And this whole nonsense that somehow life was so good back in the Stone Age, you know, before the wheel, before things got all screwed up. You know, when we were out, you know, killing animals with sharp sticks and stones. You know, the good old days when you died from tonsillitis when you were 10 years old.
I want to hear from all the listeners out there that want to wash their, beat their clothes on the rocks and carry the water on their head.
Beat their clothes? What clothes? You mean beat their leather wrapping? Carry the water on the head and what? The pail? That's an Iron Age invention.
You got to be careful what you say when I'm taking a sip of coffee.
Elizabeth
William.
Just blew coffee out her nose. Again, we need the webcams. Darn it. Well, it's true, though, because, you know, I don't know. Are your Native American populations up there considered like their own sovereign government like they are here? Is it the same deal?
In limbo. You know, they keep walking around talking like they're a nation, but these are the smallest nations in the world. They lay claim to vast areas of land that, you know, depending on who you talk to, they do or do not own. And even amongst themselves, they dispute, who claims what piece of land. But yeah, they're claiming the whole country. That's their private property.
Okay. Same kind of deal. They're claiming, right now, our biggest thing is water. And and so we've just had a court decision come down that that they take primary water rights up there in the Klamath Basin. The Curragh Indians will take a primary water right. Well, then come the adjudicated water rights for the farmers and ranchers. Well, that, of course, comes second to the determination on how much water is needed for fish, which is, of course, a shifting target.
Yes, and the fish, how much water the fish need, how much flow they need, will, of course, be determined by the eco-high priest.
Yeah, I like that, eco-high priest.
And no one can impugn their decisions. I wrote an essay about that. If you want to go to the website, there's an essay called The Spirit of Nawapa. And it is all about water development in America. Nawapa stands for the North American Water and Power Association. Give you just a brief spiel on that.
Uh-oh, we only have 1 minute. Spiel quickly.
Between the 30s and the 60s, there was a huge amount of river diversion, hydro dam building in Canada, in the United States, a lot of irrigation. I'm sure, as you know, in California, a lot of people are dependent on water from diverted rivers and what have you. And I think that's a very good thing, to divert rivers. The Nawapa proposal was to undertake a massive water diversion program, and this was spoken about in the U.S. Congress. It to divert a lot of the rivers that are flowing in Alaska and Canada into the Arctic Ocean and divert them down into the U.S. Southwest, into Arizona, New Mexico, California, northern Mexico, etc. And this would, of course, cause a great agricultural boom in those areas. And they came very close to doing that.
Okay, we're going to...
The environmental movement killed it. The environmental movement killed a lot of major hydro dam projects since then.
We'll be right back. We got 5 minutes of news coming here on KCNR. We'll be right back with you.
You're listening to We the People here at KCNR Shasta Redding.
The second hour, another delightful episode.
Somehow the chat deteriorated into pee-pee
teepees. It really does. Well, we're talking about teepees, and I was just saying that I bought some pee-pee.
You're really going to tell them?
Yeah, I'm going to tell them. I bought some pee-pee teepees for the sprinkling wee-wee.
How do you even say that? I'm just dying.
They're actually something that works for brand new baby boys. And when I saw those in the baby store, I thought I was going to die laughing.
You bought them?
And I bought them, and I sent them off to the new mom, and I've been telling everybody I know ever since, because I just think it's hilarious. Hey, you got to get your laughs where you can, okay?
I guess I don't hang around in the right stores.
We were talking
and
about...
And we never miss an opportunity.
Yeah, that's
true.
I mean,
they're teepees, so I figured it was coherent to the conversation. Am I wrong?
Well, someone just wrote in the chat room, censor her. And they'll be left with just my snarkiness. And Bob. And we'll still have Bob.
The voice of reason here.
Somebody has to be.
Yeah, can we say TP-PP's or whatever she said?
Oh, it's...
Do we allow that?
Far too late for me to bleep it now. Let's just go with it.
Okay. All right. God. Hey, so join us at 605-4567 or go to wethepeopleradio.us. Join the chat room. It's always interesting.
Go with it. Get it?
That's it, Bob. You're getting PPTPs
hey,
for
so we're talking
Christmas
about
from Elizabeth.
Yeah.
That's what Santa's bringing you.
No. Only for new baby boys.
Oh. I saw Fred Claus last night. You know, he gave him all baseball bats. I guess he could have gotten them those.
Yeah, sure.
Instead, they would have been lighter to carry.
Yes, absolutely. You can carry them in your pocket. So, anyway.
Nine million people just changed the channel. Elizabeth rendered herself
useless.
Yeah, useless. That's the word. That's the word I was going for. Oh, my goodness. William?
All the Canadians are shaking their heads.
Yes, yes. The Canadians are disappointed. William?
Your helmets.
William, talk about fascism some more. That'll sober her up.
Okay. Well, we will pick up where we left off.
Where we muted you? We're sorry.
Of the Native American movement is this ideology called indigenousism.
Oh, yeah.
I'm an indigenous person, and I should have more rights, and my point of view is more important than yours. That sort of notion that, you know, being of the land, being of there, that was one of the main refrains of Nazi ideology. A lot of their ideology was referred to as the blood and soil speech, Bluten and Brogan. And, you know, Hitler would get up there and he'd rave on and on about how the indigenous German people, the people whose blood rose out of the soil. You know, if you, you know, listen to what some of these Native American leaders are saying, you know, about, you know, our people, you know, having been from this land, you know, we are entitled to X, Y, and Z. That's classic Nazi propaganda. Indigenousism. And it can be used in a lot of European countries by the people with a longer history in the area to sort of disenfranchise and exclude and marginalize a lot of other people. It doesn't really work so well in a land like America where almost everybody is an immigrant if you go back enough generations, including, of course, our sacred native brothers who did, you know, come across, you know, the Bering Straits from Beringia 10,000 years ago. But it doesn't really ring as well. But without a doubt, that indigenousism, which the environmental movement and its allies are spreading around the New World as a means to, you know, thwart development, this is classic fascist propaganda.
Well, and then also make people, I mean, along with that, or the companion to that that allows it to work, is our political correctness obsession. So you're not allowed to say anything. Otherwise, I mean, this whole program, you know, we're all considered, you know, climate deniers and haters now.
I mean, a climate hater.
Yeah, we're just climate haters. But would you say that Mother Earth or Mother Nature wasn't all that great?
I know. This is something humanity is constantly at war with the elements. I mean, we don't want to go back to living in a world where, you know, we're living in lean-tos and putting up with rain and hail and what have you and snow. And humanity emerges in resistance to Mother Nature. It's full of toxins. It's full of poisonous animals and predators and harsh weather conditions. This is not something we want to leave, you know, unchanged. We want to live in comfortable abodes and have plenty of food, and have electricity, and hot and cold running water. This is what makes life worth living.
And yet they think they can, you know, this movement pitches, because it's always all about the sales pitch, because they're always looking for, you know, new people to vote for the folks that'll do the stuff that they want them to do. So they're always selling it. And somehow they've painted this magical picture that you can live in a forward-moving society while using completely regressive methods to do it. Take out the dams, you know, what about the flooding? You know, what about all those things? What about the lack of hydropower? So then what are you going to use? You're going to use solar that no one can afford, that's inefficient, wind, you know, well, it whacks up your bird population and mars your landscape. None of these things are efficient enough to power what we are currently doing.
Well, and if you just use common sense... It's that simple. Common sense and look for logic, and there is none. But, you know, it's funny how we can justify away the fact that it doesn't make sense. Somehow we make that okay, because somewhere, if we dig deep enough, it might all come together.
Yeah, sounds good.
It comes together when you realize that we are the target of economic warfare. There are people in Europe who have no interest in seeing America bloom and prosper. Economic warfare is a political cultural campaign whereby you suppress economic activity in another country. Countries like Germany, Italy, and these places, they have almost no natural resources. If market forces were allowed to go their way, those countries are basically doomed. They don't have any oil. They've got very little coal. They've got no uranium. They simply don't have the natural resources to have a competitive energy industry. Those countries are home to, you know, the solar power industries, the wind power industries. A lot of the major wind power manufacturers are situated in Europe. It's in their interest if the whole world was to transfer away from coal and oil and towards renewable energies, green energies and what have you. That is in their interest that that happens. It is in the interest of any political region or jurisdiction that does not have oil and coal and gas and those sorts of resources that we transition away from that. Because ultimately those, you know, the cheapest forms of electricity are definitely coal, uranium, hydro dams, things like that. But that is not an option that all countries or all jurisdictions have. So one of their ways to level the playing field is to transition the entire world away from the best forms of energy creation, electricity creation, towards these really goofy ones like wind power and solar power, which are intermittent and expensive land hogs that are not at all suitable for, you know, certainly vast countries like America. Stick with coal. But, you know, America is sort of under attack. And it's not as though that there isn't a huge constituency within America that is supporting this. That is also true. I mean, that's why that whole, you know, the American oligarchy thing, the Rockefeller family, the Kennedy family, the Pew family, Ted Turner, I could give you a list of probably 100 men who have given over $100 million out of their own pockets to the environmental movement. It's not entirely a foreign imposition, but in many ways it's a civil war between the Northeast, you know, Bangor, Maine, down to Washington, D.C., against the rest of the country.
Okay, so Ted Turner, largest private landowner in America, what's in it for him, as an example?
He's a bit of an oddball. Unlike a lot of the other American oligarchs, he really was not born onto the sort of Ivy League Northeast crowd, like the Pews and the Rockefellers and the Mellons and them. He very much wanted to be a member of that community. I think his ticket into that establishment was his embrace of environmentalism. Anybody who's a major landowner like that, ultimately, they don't want to see a free market in land. They want to preserve the value of their land assets that they do have. But he's very much an oddball. He's also, you know, very much a sort of reactionary throwback type of person. But it makes more, if you look more at sort of the Rockefellers, the people who own the U.S. Northeast, like, you know, cast your mind to, you know, New York City and Philadelphia and all those cities, all that real estate there. That's worth trillions of dollars. If America really had a free enterprise system, there would be a tremendous migration of wealth and capital and people and political power westward and southward. And in many ways, the U.S. Northeast would become a bit of a backwater. So those wishing to preserve the metropolitan role of the U.S. Northeast are active and willing participants in the suppression of economic development in the West. And that has been the case for over 100 years in America.
Well, I think that a lot of people think that it's just, you know, George Soros. Just,
oh,
you know, he's kind of like the name that comes up the most. He's sort of like the king of all the bad stuff that happens. But it's way wider than that.
Oh, I'm definitely not a conspiracy theorist. I try to impress that in a lot of the things that I write there. We are dealing with a social movement, and that is not a conspiracy. Inside America, there's probably around 10 to 15,000 environmental organizations. These are legally incorporated groups that have budgets and meetings and boards of directors. There's almost, you know, 10 to 15,000 of them. It's hard to get a precise number because they come in and out of existence, what have you. Around the world, you're probably looking at 40,000. These are structured organizations. They're funded, you know, from government. They're funded from big foundations. But there's no way you're going to find a small cabal of 40 people sitting around a walnut table guiding the environmental movement. You know, people who want to focus on George Soros or Maurice Strong, they'll pick this or that person. That's very misleading. This is a movement, if you could narrow it down to, you know, just the extremely wealthy participants, you'd still be talking about thousands of people. And they do not meet on a regular basis in some sort of structured institutional format. And it's also a semi-institutionalized social movement, which means that over the last 30 or 40 years, they very successfully appropriated a lot of state assets. And every country in the world has organizations like the EPA in America. Every province in Canada has one. Every state of the union has one. The closest this movement comes to having a central guiding force is the United Nations Environment Program, which is an organization that has a budget of around $300 or $400 million a year. And it has annual meetings, or it hosts annual meetings, that invite environmental ministers from around the world. And I've seen photographs of some of those meetings, and you know, envision something that looks like the UN General Assembly, you know, hundreds of men sitting around desks, and every one of them is an environmental minister. And they meet on an annual basis. That's as close as this movement comes to having a central guiding body. The United Nations Environment Program, that bureaucracy, has within it a department that has a direct contact with 6,000 of the world's largest environmental organizations. And there's a constant flow of information back and forth between the UNEP and the world's 6,000 largest environmental organizations. So it is coordinated to that degree, but it's really a mistake to view it as a small conspiracy.
Okay. And you had written an article about that, and I will find it on the break. And when we come back, I wanted to know more. So we've got 2 minutes, folks, to grab some coffee. We're speaking with William Kay here on We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Syrup, a glacier-filled Arctic, not a frozen cold Europe. Coastlines not eroding, corals not bleaching. These are a few of my favorite things. New FedEx hybrids and Fred Krupp's old Prius. Solar and wind farms and biofuels will free us from a Mideast oil clench and the risks that it brings. Solutions are a few of my favorite things. When Limbaugh
Oh, Bob, how do you do it? Okay, that's a real song, right? They sit around and sing that instead of Kumbaya now?
I think that has displaced Kumbaya.
Oh, my gosh. How do you do it, Bob?
Where do you find them all? Jeez.
Actually, found that one on YouTube.
No wonder you stay up so late at night.
In fact, I will give them credit. It's the Environmental Defenses featuring Erica Roll and James Wang. Or Wong, I guess that is. James Wong.
Oh, God. Wang, should we go? Let's go
back to the TPP.
Let's run on that thread.
God.
So,
oh my gosh.
I can't help that my daughter-in-law didn't have a baby girl.
Jeez. Hey, William, we forgot to warn you about the music. It's so distracting for us. We're just, gosh.
Yeah. Hey, welcome back.
We get derailed so easily.
Welcome back. You see, people that do radio shows really have short attention spans. Apparently.
I don't know any other people who do radio shows. Except William. William used to do one in Vancouver, right?
Yeah. And William.
Well, tell us about that.
Yeah, we want to hear about that show.
Okay. The station was CFRO in Vancouver. It was sort of a volunteer gig. I did a Friday noon hour news show. And over the course of it, I started to interview leading climate skeptics. And this managed to really irritate people. And then I started to do a lot of shows where I would talk about the leading financiers of the environmental movement, you know, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, things like that. And that thoroughly enraged people. I started getting death threats on the air. And then over a two-year period, I watched the environmental movement take over that station and fire me. Not that it was really paying you. I could walk away from it at any time. But I watched them, and it was at one point, there was a full-page write-up in the Vancouver Sun, which is the major newspaper in British Columbia, about what was going on. One of the business press started to pick up on it, too. And I managed to rally enough support that we could prevent my show being canceled for a while. But eventually, it was canceled. And I watched them systematically, you know, stack annual general meetings and do things like that, and then get their people put into that bureaucracy there, and eventually, for sure, boom, that show got canceled. And it was through the environmental pressure. But near the end, I was really not pulling any punches and really explaining to people what was happening. And this is British Columbia. That was where it was happening. And I'll just give you an example of British Columbia. They surveyed the world's leading 100 mining companies, and they said, create a list of the areas of the world where there are the greatest resources, and then create a list of the areas of the world based on how easy or how difficult it is to get a mine started. And British Columbia came sixth in the world as the wealthiest in terms of mineral resources, and it came 100th in terms of how difficult it is to get a mine going. I mean, there's a huge amount of wealth sitting there of every conceivable mineral, and it's almost impossible at present, due to the power of the environmental movement, to get a mine going. The struggle continues, and there's some talk about some new mines now. Also, during the course of my tenure in British Columbia, I watched them destroy the forestry industry and hobble the aquaculture industry, etc. So this is an area where there's such a tremendous opportunity for economic growth, yet it has been definitely targeted by the environmental movement, and the boot is really on. And, you know, population 4 million people, 500 environmental organizations, most of them have paid staff.
Jeez.
Most of that money is coming from outside the province.
Wow, you guys are, you sound just like us.
I was going to say, I think you might rival San Francisco. That's
well, nice. Oh, yeah, it's very much, you get that impression. It's sort of like this is the land of the environmentalist. But once again, that's a misperception. You know, we think of, you know, flaky San Francisco and that. That in large way measure is, those people are, you know, a colonial outpost of the East Coast. They are there to prevent development on the West Coast. But if you really take a good look at the U.S. big green organizations, the money's coming from the East. R. Anderson Pugh, I estimate he's given $2 billion to the environmental movement. That's with a B.
Dang.
Philadelphia, blood and soil.
Your one, the one article listed here on the webpage, the American Oligarchy's Economic Warfare Campaign, and I clicked on the part, the section that said American Oligarchy's Foundations and Environmentalism in General, and here was where I found the part that I was thinking of before our last break. Although there's no institutional structure governing the environmental movement, there are several organizations whose chartered mission is to unite and coordinate the tens of thousands of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, funding agencies, and government departments and sub-departments that make up the modern environmental movement. This one centralizing institution is the Environmental Grant Makers Association.
Oh, the EGA.
Yeah, and I'd never heard of them before. So this is back in 2000 that this was written. So what's the...
I've written about them again. They've got their own website. Okay, hold thought number one. You hadn't heard of them before. Thought number two, that group is probably organizing $600 to $700 million a year in grants to American environmental organizations. Thought number three, they do not represent all of the big grantors. There are some very large foundations, like the Ford Foundation, that are not members of the EGA. The Environmental Grantmakers Association, I think it dates to the 1980s. A lot of the wealthy philanthropists in America, particularly the East Coast ones, have long been giving money to conservation groups and what have you. The EGA was an initiative of the Rockefeller family to centralize and coordinate this giving of money to these groups so that it could be done in a more systematic fashion, so they wouldn't be overlapping. They could geographically divide up America and make sure that every square inch had a defender to protect it from development. And so I think right now the Environmental Grantmakers Association has about 200 or 300 members. You can check their website. They're kind of secretive about exactly who they are and who all of their members are. There's sort of a members-only section of the website where a lot of the real stuff, I'm sure, gets discussed. But a lot of, like, the Pew Charitable Trust Foundations, a lot of these big outfits, they hand out hundreds of millions of dollars a year to the environmental movement. The EGA was simply an effort to coordinate a lot of the medium-sized and a few of the larger ones so they would have a systematic fashion. But they alone, you know, several hundred million to a billion a year being dispersed to several thousand different environmental organizations. Many of the sort of rinky-dink, you know, save this river, save this bush environmental groups, they would have no existence at all absent the money that's coming down from on high. The EGA itself does not give out money. It's a rather small bureaucracy. Its sole function is to hold forums and venues whereby the bureaucrats with inside the major enviro philanthropies can get together and hash out a coordinated strategy. But it is crucial that people understand that the environmental movement is a mercenary movement. You know, Joe Blow walking around with a sign down there, he's being paid to be there. This movement is very thin on the ground. There's very little volunteerism in this movement. Those who are volunteering in this movement are doing so with the hope of ultimately getting a job within one of these organizations.
Well,
so that's an important feature, and it's literally billions of dollars coming down, like from the MacArthur Foundation, the Packard Foundation.
Oh, yeah. The money in this article was mind-blowing. And that's at the end, I looked at this thing. I'm like, okay, that's in 2000. Somewhere between 128 and 200 major eco-funding agencies are members of the EGA and thus send representatives to EGA conventions, et cetera. And, you know,
well, that's very dated. That's 2000.
I know, that's what I'm talking about.
Again, there's another out there.
It's 11 years ago, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's much larger than that now. You know, think of a term that, you know, those, when you view these small groups that are usually quite designated geographically, like Save This River, Save This Park, those groups, they now cover almost every acre of America as sort of an environmental group, you know, designated towards prohibiting development on that area. And part of the EGA's function was to get that happening so that it wasn't, you know, all these groups putting their money into the same location. So now it's very geographically divided up. But think in terms of billions of dollars coming from on high.
Wow.
You know, a lot of these wealthy families, they own square miles of downtown Philadelphia. Not short of cash at all.
Yeah, interesting. Well,
it's easy to find out about them because the law is that if you're going to be a registered charitable foundation, you must, one, disperse 5% of your net assets per year. But, of course, their revenues exceed that, so they get larger as it is. And the Ford Foundation is now sitting on $11 billion, maybe more. But also, by law, they're required to open their books. You know, as they say, you know, the greatest secrets of British history are found in the shelves of the public library. You know, the greatest secrets of American history are open public knowledge. Anybody can go to the websites of the Pew Charitable Trust, you know, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. You can look it all up. They will list all the environmental groups that they are funding, and they'll give you the dollar figure right beside them.
I believe that form is a 990, and it's public knowledge. You can pull that up on the internet.
Yeah, it's a 990 tax form. It's hard to get the actual tax forms, I'm finding, for a lot of them, but they're pretty forthcoming themselves within their websites because they know that ultimately, if you want to sleuth around, you can get the actual tax forms themselves. They're a bit stiffer reading, but yeah, some of that's also posted online.
All right, guys.
My point is, this is no great mystery. This is no great mystery that, you know, these wealthy foundations are bankrolling this movement. Although there's an impression that somehow environmentalism is a grassroots movement of Californians, you know, fighting to defend, you know, the quack grass. That's a myth.
All right. And on that note, you guys have 2 minutes to check out ecofascism.com, which is William's website. We've got Don Shulman, our hostage, on hold. We'll come back to you, Don, with your question on the air when we come back. And everybody else, hang tight. You're listening to We the People Radio. This is KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media. Foundation.
There you go. We'll water it down.
All right, Don Shulman, are you out there? Are you out there on hold? Still?
Are you in Radio Land, Don?
All right. Which one do you want? Doesn't matter.
Don gave up on us. He's talking to his wife while he's on hold. Don?
Which one do you want? Doesn't matter.
Okay, we're going to have to mute Don, because Don is jamming up the airwaves with all sorts of static.
Oh, okay. How are you?
I think he's getting, there he is.
Don, was your wife giving you a honey-do list?
Am I on there now?
Yes. Sorry about that.
Did you lose consciousness there for a little while?
Okay, I would love to see the environmentalists live for 2 or 3 months like they want us to live.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fun?
That's harsh,
Don. Wouldn't that be a great way to go? Say, all right, guys, you want us to ride horses and bicycles and you want us to do all this stuff, you try it out for 3 months, then we'll come back and look at it.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet they change their tune, especially all these Rockefeller people and all these other people who live, you know, I don't care how they made, you know, I don't care what they do with their money. That's their business, but don't tell us how to live.
Well, it's amazing because I know a handful of what I consider to be liberal people in our area. And
what? You didn't tell me that.
I do. I'm afraid so. Back when I didn't know any better, I used to hang out with them.
What?
Anyway, but so many of them live in your little cookie cutter neighborhoods. They don't compost. They don't grow gardens. I mean, they don't do any of the things that supposedly we're supposed to be doing to prevent, you know, to save the environment, to cut down on cost, to cut down on energy usage. I don't see them doing it. It's
what's
really
interesting is when my wife and I were in Europe, Italy, we were riding along, taking a little tour, and we saw people throw trash outside of their car windows. And we said to our driver, what's that all about? Oh, we do it all the time. And then he was drinking a bottle of water, and we said, oh, where do you recycle? He says, what's that? We don't recycle.
Yeah, man after my own heart.
So we are one of the few people who do all of this stuff, and the rest of the world just doesn't comply.
Yeah, because
I like recycling because it gives us extra money for turning in all these bottles.
But if they stop paying you, would you keep doing it?
Would I? I don't think so. To be real honest with you,
I like it when you're real honest with us, Don. We expect that. We know when you're lying. We're like Santa.
Oh, okay. My nose will grow a lot more.
We'll see you when you come in for your show at 11.
I think we just put you on the naughty list.
Hey, what's your show about today, by the way?
Oh, we're talking about long-term care and Alzheimer's and the book I wrote, How Not to Forget Anything, and when I find it, I'll start giving it out to people.
Just in time to hide your own Easter eggs. That's awesome.
Right. Well, thanks. Very interesting show. Thank you.
Thanks, Don. See you later.
Thanks, Don.
So William, we have other climate haters out there.
Bring them on. They're
starting to coalesce. We're going to start our own club.
Okay, condemned. Go bring them on.
We're not going to have a nonprofit though, because if we do, then we've got to tell everybody who we are. So we're just gonna hold it secretly in our hearts.
All there's ways around that.
Oh, okay. So somebody asked about eugenics. How does that factor into all this?
Well, very closely, because the American Eugenics Society renamed itself a while ago to the Planned Parenthood Society. It was formerly called the Eugenics Society. It was an openly racist organization. The population control movement works hand in glove with the environmental movement. It's been a core belief of environmentalism from its inception that the world is overpopulated. They were arguing the world was overpopulated over 200 years ago. And regardless of how much the population grows and how much the wealth grows, they're still convinced that there's too many people. And if you go to most of the big environmental groups, they continue putting out this overpopulation scare line. The belief is, more people, more cars, more houses, more damage to Mother Earth, what have you. That's the argument. It's also a way to justify all kinds of nasty policies. But you should really view the environmental movement and the population control movement as real Siamese twins. And the population control movement, there's a lot of groups that are organized, a lot of them are embedded in other organizations. There's the UN Population Control Program. It has hundreds of millions of dollars in its budget. It's very sinister, and people really underestimate the degree to which the population control movement, or the Malthusian movement, has influenced culture. And some of this we probably don't even want to get into on the air, but they have profoundly influenced cultures in ways to suppress population growth. I don't know how much of this you want me to get into.
Go ahead. Last week we talked about the Gulf oil spill as a nice way to depopulate the Gulf so they could grow their...
I don't buy into anything like that.
Grow their algae.
I was saying, the promotion of homosexuality in America and other places was primarily driven by the population control movement. And I'm not saying that people do not have the right to, have sex with their shoes if they want to. I don't care. But
way to be random.
The idea that there should be a broad-based cultural campaign to promote homosexuality, which started in America, the campaign started in America, really, it came out of the Rockefeller Brothers, and et cetera, really got going in the 1960s and what have you. That was a campaign to suppress population growth, and it's actually been rather successful. The same can be said about sort of abortion on demand, things like that. You've always got to separate, what people's rights are from really who's driving the movement and why are they driving the movement.
Follow the money.
Around the world, there's really nasty, surgical sterilization campaigns that'll blow your mind if you want to read about what's been done in places like Peru and India, widespread surgical sterilization, all kinds of nasty tricks to get women to go along with that. But in the first world, there's been a real promotion of mechanisms to break down the nuclear family as a way to reduce the number of children people are having. And it's been very successful, and it operates hand in glove with the environmental movement. Almost all of the main funders of the environmental movement, those big foundations, are also major funders of various population control programs. The two movements are inextricable. And they have had a profound influence on culture.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of guilt. Why are you having all these children? We can't fit all these people on the earth. And it just kills me because there's, I don't remember the guy's name, but there's a guy who regularly puts up YouTube videos just... showing the amount of population, and the one video he had on there, it's like a cartoon, but the one video he had on there was if the world had a dance party and everybody got 6 feet of the dance floor, how much space that would take up to invite the entire world. And it was tiny.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's tiny.
You could put the entire population of the world could live in detached, single-family houses within the state of Texas, the entire population of the world.
And yet we're crushing the world because there's so many of us. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
It's a myth. This world could support great magnitudes more number of people than we currently have now. And as we grow and as we develop new technology, we have no worries about overpopulation. Our ability to generate food and grow food is growing at a much faster rate than the human race is.
Well, and then...
We're not the only species that multiplies prolifically. So does wheat. So does corn. There's no shortage of our capacity to generate food. I know it's an issue along California, aquaculture, salmon farms, various fish farms. And I know that the environmental movement has been very successful in California in suppressing that industry. Huge political battle in British Columbia over this. But if you want to talk about creating vast amounts of very cheap food, get into fish farming. Other places in the world are really going ahead full steam with this. We're not doing it in North America due to environmental suppression. But tremendous opportunity there to generate food.
Well, it's interesting, too, because of the way that they're doing some of this, you know, moving these fish from place to place to place to try to broaden the endangered species footprint and those kinds of things. They're seeing a virus, a bacteria, actually. I should look this up. I've got it on my email. They've got a bacteria that's kind of overtaking the fishery, and they're looking at long-term serious implications. So amount of water will be small compared to that. I'll look it up. We've got to take a quick break here. Otherwise, we'll be up against top of the hour. We want to give William Kay plenty of time to wrap up for us in all this wide range of topics that we've talked about this morning. You're listening to We the People Radio at KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Elizabeth on helium.
No, that was just Bob. Bob's like, I have kind of a wacky Christmas song. Can I play it? And what's our answer to everything? Yes.
It, wackier the better.
We're like bad permissive parents. Hey, what do you want to do? Yeah, so, sure, do it.
So my mom used to have a flower shop, and when we got really bored, she and I would go in the back and load up on helium and then call people on the phone. My mother did that. It was fun.
That explains so much. I just had to say that for all you people out there that are going, exactly.
Now we get it.
Now we know what the deal is. Back to my research on the infectious zones in the river. I can't find the dang email that explains it, but anyway, I will, and I'll put it online. So William, we have 10 hot minutes. What would you like to talk about that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, if we're into the wrap-up mode, the main thing is that it's about being socially conscious. It's about being politically conscious. This is the great struggle of our age, of our time. There is a massive political movement known as the environmental movement, which is seeking political control. They are seeking to secure their control of governments. They have established beachheads in most governments, and they have a great ability to influence political parties, but they are a long ways from completing what they really want to do. They are still a social movement. They still perceive of themselves as being marginalized. And they are struggling for greater political power. And that process, wherein they push for greater power and they appropriate ever bits more of the state process, is the great struggle of our age. And in its wake, there is this great cultural campaign going on that, you know, muddies the waters and confuses people. But it's trying to, you know, penetrate through to the roots of that and seeing the real tectonic struggle between the various social groups that are lining up on both sides of this. That's what I'm trying to do with ecofascism.com, is to
try to shine some light on that. One of the things I wrote recently included with it, there's one of the more recent essays is called the Tar Sands Campaign, and it's about the effort by the environmental movement to block oil sands development in Alberta, where I currently live. There's vast oil fields, but they're not conventional oil fields. The oil is in the ground itself, and they extract it through various processes. But it's a vast field. It's larger than the oil fields of Iraq. And we're well into it now, developing it. It's over 2 million barrels a day is being produced from it. In any event, in the course of studying that, I came across some stuff by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And there's a priceless report that they put out in March of 2011. This is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the report highlighted how many energy projects in the United States are currently or have recently been killed or stalled by environmental activism. And they counted 333 projects. They said the total investment that would have gone into those projects would have been over $500 billion. The spinoffs would have been over $1 trillion. Those facilities would be operating for 20 years had they been allowed to be built. And you can check it out on the Chamber of Commerce's website. And one of the interesting things, they had a hard time getting a news conference to promote the issuance of this report. But these kinds of stuff, that's 333 separate energy projects. You know, there were 22 nuclear reactor projects that had been stymied. The whole Yucca Mountain nuclear storage facility was stymied. There's 111 coal-fired plants or coal-to-liquid projects that have been stymied. This is going on in every state of the Union, primarily in the West, in the South. You know, anyone who tries to build an energy project in the United States is just beset upon by environmentalists who use existing regulatory processes. They use lawsuits. They use protests. They use media campaigns. They do whatever they can to suppress and sabotage and delay the project. And frequently, if they can drag it out for enough years, you know, the investors get skittish and take off, and they've effectively destroyed it.
Yeah, we see that a lot.
It's like a civil war. If America is not allowed to build the energy plants that it needs for the future, America is going to have a retarded economic program. All of these other industries are dependent on energy. One of the great competitive advantages North America has vis-a-vis Japan and Europe is we are capable of creating very cheap energy and having very cheap land. And that's one way we can attract investment and have a really competitive manufacturing sector is by exploiting that competitive advantage. That is what is being taken away from us. But, you know, you see it in Canada and you see it in the United States. Anybody who tries to build a major energy project, look out. You know, you better be prepared for 7 years of legal battles and protests and people, you know, sabotaging your plant and laying down on logging roads and doing whatever they can do to block you from doing this.
Yeah.
So that's a reality that we live in today, and it's having an impact. It's having a direct impact on the price people are paying for energy, on the price they're paying for housing, on the price they're paying for food. So they're really hurting people with these programs.
Well, and I guess at the end of the day, you know, I'm sure we, you know, where possible, we attempt to be solution oriented. However, when it comes to this, all you can really do is shine light in all the corners of the room. And I guess from this program, I would hope that most people would walk away and realize that leaving California isn't going to solve all your problems for one. I mean, solve some, but won't solve all of them. It's everywhere. And if it isn't where you are, it really is. You just haven't seen it yet. By not paying attention. So this is pervasive worldwide. And the other thing, too, is we focus a lot on the Agenda 21 strategy coming out of the UN. And that explains a lot, and that helps people kind of get on the bigger picture. However, I think that after today, people will realize it's much wider than that, that actually narrows the scope a little too much. And leaves out a lot of the cast of characters, I guess, if you will.
Well, Agenda 21, it's sort of like the conspiracy theory. It is one document
of a great many that expose the nature of the environmental movement. But if you read it itself, it's just larded with euphemisms. And the whole UN style of writing, they call it, you know, transparently impenetrable. You know, you can read pages and pages of stuff. And
transparently impenetrable. I like that.
That's the sort of style there. It's all euphemism. Every word is sort of actually refers to something else. It's heavily coded language that they use. But without a doubt, yeah, they are talking about creating, you know, an international government that will be dominated by Europe and will have a very restrictive... The word, actually, the fancy word, which is now dated, is corporatism, which does not mean ruled by corporations. It means basically, you know, from a form of economy that's heavily regulated, where every particular industry has got an official government bureaucracy that dictates how much is going to be produced and where it's going to be produced. There's still a lot of private ownership. Certainly land will remain privately owned. The existing landed fortunes are not going to be touched. But it is not by any means capitalism, and it's not by any means democracy. This was sort of, fascist economics was called corporatism, where they would create these little sort of bureaucracies that would guide and govern all economic activity. That's sort of what they have in mind, to create that on an international scale. And if, you know, you and I would be in concentration camps by the time that happened, I assure you.
You know, that's what the guy last week told us.
Yeah, said the same thing.
We'd be the first to go, and so Aaron and I decided what we were going to wear.
Stripes would look good.
Yeah. We're not very clever with our outfits. No, we shop in the non-clever section.
Yeah, I envisioned us in little striped black and white outfits with cute little hats.
Yeah, yeah.
Orange overalls, anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Or really
green overalls.
A big onesie, and Elizabeth will be running around with her TPPs.
It's worth a full entry of its own, but you can scour the literature of various leading environmentalists like David Suzuki in Canada or, you know, Bobby Kennedy, and they often let slip ideas that, you know, the people who are denying climate change should be locked up in jail. You can make a great quote.
William, we got to tell you bye. We're out of time. Fox News is going to overtake
us. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Listen to We the People Radio next week. Bye, folks.
Bye, Aaron. Bye, Elizabeth.
Polar bears playing, Vermont maple syrup, a glacier-filled Arctic, not a frozen cold Europe, coastlines not eroding, corals not bleaching. These are a few of my favorite things. New FedEx hybrids and Fred Krupp's old Prius, solar and wind farms and biofuels will free us from a Mideast oil cleanse and the risks that it brings. Solutions are a few of my favorite things.